Hello and welcome to this once-in-a-lifetime celebration. We're here to celebrate the release of this two-volume book that features the first 50 years of Prairie. And we people that were working on it, which are Barb Park, Rosemary Dorney, and Ruth Caldwell there in the red, and me, of course, we don't think we're going to be around. We don't think we're going to be around in the next 50 years, so you know that's why we had to write two volumes, right?
You guys get to do the next one.
So anyway, I want to give thanks to all of you who helped make this book happen. And of course, the committee was we were the ones that just kept meeting and meeting and meeting for 94 times, and usually 2 or 3 hour meetings. And then we did work in between, just to let you know. And if you bought a book, or if you're just sitting at a table, you'll see there's Prairie by the numbers that gives you some of the numbers, you know, how many meetings, how many pages in the book, how many other people contributed. How many of you know that you have something in the book that you wrote? Well, look around, everybody.
And the list is right there.
And the list is there. That's one of the numbers. We met monthly. And we found out that we didn't do much work if we met monthly, because we would just, you know, the week that we were going to meet, we'd look to see what we were supposed to do, and then we would do it. So then we decided we better meet once every 2 weeks, because then we would get more work done. And then before the 50th anniversary party in 2017, in September of 2017, we were kind of in a crunch, because we had to prepare for that. And so then we met every week. And then we went back to meeting once every 2 weeks, and then before this, for a while, we were meeting for every week. That's how we got 94 meetings. But believe it or not, it's not only been hard work, but it's been a lot of fun. We've gotten to know each other a lot better and to enjoy each other. And you know what we would do when we were at the writing phase is we would read our articles to each other. So it was like fun. That was really fun. So what else do I want to say here? I'm not going to name the other people, but they are on that Prairie by the Numbers that's on your table or stuck in your book if you actually bought a book. It's an up on the wall. Those are all the different authors of something in the book. You know, writing, that might be something out of the Prairie Fire. It might be something out of the Minutes. It might be an actual bio that somebody wrote about how they happened to come to Prairie, or something like that. So there are about 100 names on there, right, Barb? And she wrote them all by hand. So now we have about a 35-minute program for you to sort of whet your appetite for the book, you know, because it's long, and we want to know there's fun stuff in it. And we hope you learn a little bit from it and that you're really entertained. We know you're going to be entertained. And then afterward, if you haven't got your book yet, or you know, you want to buy one, buying will be open again. And if you want to get autographs from one of these 100 people, or a bunch of them, you can. But you don't have to. And, you know, there'll still be food, there'll still be things to eat. So, and lots of people to visit with, so feel free to stay as long as you want. And we're going to start with our reading from an excerpt from the prologue to the book. It was written by Ruth Caldwell, and she will be reading it, and it's called The Effect of the Vietnam War on Prairie's Development.
Okay. I would like to, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I would like to give a tribute to our intrepid leader, Mary yes. Mullen, without whom this book would not be written.
Really.
Driver, though she
yes,
be.
Okay. All right. Prairie's earliest years, those formative years of 1967 to 72, coincided with the war in Vietnam. Madison was well known as one of the epicenters of anti-Vietnam demonstrations involving not only the University of Wisconsin students, but many faculty and townspeople as well. The pervading cultural mood, you remember this, was anti-establishment, anti-institutional. Authority at all levels of society was questioned and often viewed with suspicion. Within many institutions, there was a conflict between those who supported the original goals and patterns and those who wanted to break free of established ways and chart their own course. That was especially true of the newly started Prairie Society. That tussle between the traditionalists and the innovators was the crucible in which Prairie Society was formed. It fashioned the direction the young society took, and it was the backdrop to many of our parish meetings in which the original goals were questioned. Should we build a church or not? Should we call a minister? These questions, which kept surfacing for many years, were referred to as, here we go round the mulberry bush again. Perhaps this controversy is best understood by two compelling examples. Joan and Bill Burns were First Society members, excited by the prospect of being part of a young UU society. And Joan's commitment ran deep, and she was an early president of Prairie. But growing up as a Roman Catholic, she was used to and expected professional clergy. And when part-time minister Dave Meyer, who's over here, left in 1972 and the congregation decided to become completely lay-led, she and Bill went back to the First Society. A polar opposite example is Joe and Terry Lawrence, who had been part of a breakaway group from the First Society. While Dave Meyer was a minister from 1970 to 72, they did not attend Prairie. But in September 1972, when Prairie became completely lay-led, they returned to the congregation. A confirmation of the presence of these two factions in Prairie is shown in this striking document written in 1971. The author, Bob Kale, who was president from 1968 to 69 and one of the lay ministers in 1971, offered a plan to deal with this problem. And guess what it was? Essentially, his solution was to eventually separate those two groups into two UU societies. That never happened.
Well, one of the most colorful characters in Prairie's history was our first minister, who was just a six-month minister on loan from the Unitarian Universalist Association in 1969. This is before Dave Meyer was here, and it was a Reverend Lanier Clance. And we've asked Rosemary Doring to share what Ruth Caldwin wrote about Reverend Clance.
Our loan minister. During the spring of 1969, Prairie Society engaged the Reverend R. Lanier Clance, a minister on loan from the UUA and then minister of the First Universalist Church of North Olmsted, Ohio. He came to give professional help to the young congregation and to offer his recommendations for growth. Self-described as a Southern existentialist, he was a colorful presence for a whirlwind stay of 6 weeks. Remember, this was the late 1960s. After 5 weeks with Prairie, Reverend Clance wrote in his April 23, 1969 letter to the congregation, "I still say that you need vision for the present and for the future. A vision that can be stated as simply as the following," and this is in boldface, "a refuge for rebels, a haven for heretics, a shelter for skeptics, a fellowship of individuals." At his final service, Reverend Clance stood behind a cloud of incense, clothed in a liturgical robe of his own choosing, best described as a red silk bathrobe, with a dragon emblazoned on the back. In front of him was an array of shot glasses that he had carried to Madison in the trunk of his car. He had wanted to fill them with bourbon for a final celebratory toast with the congregation, but was advised that it was more appropriate to use wine with the northern congregation, and so wine it was. The Reverend Clance died in 2013 in Atlanta, where he had been the founder and minister of the First Existential Church, Existentialist Church of Atlanta. That was our founding father.
So our second minister was Dave Meyer, who's right there in the purple shirt, who served with us for 2 years, 1970 to 72. He and his wife, Pat, were very, who's there too, right next to him, were both very involved with the congregation. They were kind enough to write a memoir, which occupies 70 pages of volume one. And I've asked Al to read a very, very brief excerpt from it. We should have asked him, but we didn't. So Al is being paid.
Prairie was my first, and as it turned out, my only church. Just as I was Prairie's first minister. Prairie as a community understood, and I as a religious professional agreed, that religion is inseparable from the secular world around us. This understanding informed much of what we did at Prairie. For example, on the Sunday closest to Veterans Day, I directed a presentation of all of the war poems of the great British poet Wilfred Owens, who was killed a week before the armistice in 1918. The voices reading the poems were intentionally all women's in order to contrast the presenters with the war scenes that they were presenting. Other Sunday programs also addressed numerous issues from race relations to the Vietnam War, to concepts of marriage and relationships, to feminist issues, etc. I was quite conscious of not taking a traditional clerical role, and so had agreed with Prairie's leadership that I would only formally lead services once a month while working with the worship committee to coordinate the other services.
Well, so that's the first chapter. Most people would have, churches writing history would have ended at the end of the chronological chapter, which is about 150 pages, but we decided to go on for another 200. The second chapter is about Prairie symbols, and we haven't included anything about that in this reading, but I'll mention that that includes our Prairie smoke symbol, the flaming chalice, which is a denominational symbol, the hymn book from the Unitarian martyr Norbert Chopic, which was given to us by his grandson, our name tags, which are back there on the back wall, our prairie, which is in the front yard. It looks like a mess right now because it's getting ready to grow, and several mawera trees that are planted on the grounds. And then there's chapter three, which is about some of our traditions, and we have several services that fall into this category. Ruth Collins is going to read about a tradition she brought to Prairie, the Day of the Dead service.
Okay. One thing I treasure about Prairie is the opportunity for members to present a service about some gripping experience or passion. For me, it was a trip in 1995 to Michoacan, Mexico, where I was bowled over by the annual Day of the Dead celebration. The element of the service would be simple. It would be a time in the midst of a supportive congregation for people to light a candle and briefly share pictures, objects, and memories of someone dear that they had lost. And the opportunity should be given, of course, to people who preferred to light a candle in silence for someone. I also thought it was important to have a reading of the names of all the Prairie members who have died. And after the service, the congregation could be invited to view the photos and objects and talk about the deceased, perhaps over a bit of pan de muertos from a local Mexican bakery. That's what we do.
Well, We've been an exceedingly musical congregation, and lists of our musicians at any decade would cover an entire page, probably 25 or 30 people or more, probably a quarter of the congregation or so. Our entire chapter 4 is about music at Prairie, and Rosemary's going to be about one of the earliest Prairie music groups. This was written by Ruth Collin. It was about the Prairie Chicken Pluckers.
Astonished by the number of accomplished and budding musicians in the congregation, a newcomer once asked, "Do you have to be a musician to be a member of Prairie?" So it is no surprise to find that a number of musical groups have graced our meetings over the years. One of the first was a memorable band with the delightful name of the Prairie Chicken Pluckers. The Chicken Pluckers were featured in a September 23, 1973 article in the Capital Times. In that article, Barbara Willard explained the uses of the musical group. "We don't have an organ or a church choir, but sometimes we need a little something for the introit. Or if a discussion is getting hot and people a little edgy, we put in a little music." George Calden also told reporter Paulette Brown that the Pluckers' grassroots flavor is symbolic of Prairie. Prairie Society, with no organ, no regular minister, is itself a grassroots organization. It has an unpolished, uncommercial, and uninstitutionalized flavor. That's what early Prairie people liked, both in their organization and in their music.
Well, we haven't included any selections from Chapter 5 on values and beliefs, but we do have one to share from Chapter 6, which is on issues. The issues chapter deals with controversies within the church, excluding those about buying or selling land or remodeling. Those are covered in the chronological chapter. Those issues, we've chosen a humorous one for this reading, and I'll be reading about the perennial issue with coffee. Secretary Dion Stevens described one of the discussions in the minutes of the December 4, 1969 board meeting. Coffee, coffee, coffee. This is the minutes. We were meeting, by the way, we were meeting then at the YWCA on the square. That's still there, but we're not meeting there, we're meeting here. Okay, so here's the minutes. Hospitality, Edmonds Hospitality Committee. The coffee situation was discussed. Several points were brought up and suggestions made. One, the Gab Fest, which centers around the coffee table at the beginning of the service, interferes with the quiet period we're trying to have. Two, we don't want to discourage friendliness. Perhaps we could have quiet time later. Imagine that. Three, the logistics of the room make it unreasonable to serve coffee throughout the service, as was done at the seminary. First we met at the seminary, Holy Name Seminary, out on the other side of the building. Four, perhaps coffee could be served only after the service. On the other hand, parents are often anxious to get home with their children right away. Five, perhaps coffee could be set up by the center doors. Six, now this is a really good one. Serving pitchers could be used to pass coffee around during the service. Can you imagine all the spills? I mean, we have spills these days. You know, people put their coffee cup under the chair and then they kick it over. And,
Mary, hold on a minute. Dan, could you pull the yellow ones towards you just a little bit?
Yeah, it's a little ringing happening. All right, so I'm going to read one more thing about coffee. This is by Fran Romica, who is one of our hospitality chairs and also took care of the yard and all the flowers for a long time. Coffee lovers. Starting September 27, the hospitality committee will conduct a four-Sunday experiment. Coffee will be available from 9:45 till 10 each Sunday morning. No coffee will be served between 10 and 11:20. Not one drop. Anyone, any attempt to violate or bend this rule will end the experiment. The will, of course,
jurisdictions that it can't work, Unitarians, in quote, can't be regimented, unquote, we want to try it. Look at it this way. It's not regimentation. It's a reward for coming early. Join us. All right, so now from the ridiculous about coffee to the sublime. Great people have always been active in the community, outside of the church. And back in the 1980s, Sanctuary for Central Americans who came were people at risk. They were really on our minds. And of course, unfortunately, that issue has returned. And Barbara's going to read two paragraphs from an article I wrote about the sanctuary movement.
Back in the 1980s, when wars were ravaging Central America and people from those countries were fleeing violence, a sanctuary movement grew up in Madison. History repeats itself. At Sunday services on 1983, 84, and 86, Prairie learned about the issues and the movement. A church in downtown Madison served as an actual sanctuary, and Prairie contributed to various refugees who passed through. A bit more daring, at some point in the mid-1980s, Shirley and John Grinrod became good friends with the Guatemalan family who were housed, supported, and protected by the Second Sight Sanctuary Group in Madison. That went on for 18 months. One of the Grinrod sons was married to the woman in charge of the family. In January 1985, the U.S. government started cracking down on sanctuary workers in the southern border states. Workers here in Madison were warned by their network to immediately move sanctuary families to safety. The refugee family was first taken to live with an elderly woman in her home outside of Madison, and then to St. Benedict Center, now Holy Wisdom Monastery. But they were basically trapped there, and it seemed time to find them true sanctuary in Canada. As Jenny Beatty explains in her account, the Second Sight group assisted them to secure legal refugee status and asylum in Canada. In reality, that meant that the Grinrods loaned out their family camper to their son and his wife to help transport the family surreptitiously out of the United States and to their new home in Winnipeg, Manitoba, where they still live today as citizens of Canada.
Now it's on to volume two with the chapter 8 called Nuts and Bolts. Because money is one of the things that holds the church together. Rosemary Doherty wrote about how our member Pat Watkins helped in this respect. And she'll do the honors of reading it too.
Yes, Pat's solution to augmenting the budget when she didn't feel she could pay out of pocket was to run trips, and what she charged for the trips, the difference between what the trips cost and what she charged for them went to Prairie. And sometimes this was almost nothing, and sometimes this was quite a bit. So Pat's creative alternative to making her annual pledge this particular time had to do with a trip to the Art Institute in Chicago. Oh, and do I remember that one? It was planned for a St. Patrick's Day. A couple of days, that's what I did too. A couple of days before departure, I called Pat and said, where do you plan for drop off and pickup? You know about Chicago's big St. Pat's Day parade, right? All of Michigan Avenue in that area will be blocked off. There'll be cops everywhere. There's no way the bus is going to get through. Pat just about had a stroke. But you can read about it in the book. It did get worked out, but you know, things like that can come up.
Now, she raised thousands of dollars for the church through those trips over, I don't know, a 10 or 20 year period. Our shortest chapter in the book in volume two is about some favorite services. Chapter 9 starts with some introductory remarks from the late George Calden's booklet called Roots and Wings.
which has the text for 9 of his services that he did. And George listed a few of his most precious memories of Prairie services up until the mid-1980s. And I was going to read an excerpt from the list of services that George liked.
Bob Cale's deeply stirring service on the meaning of bread in history. Who can forget Dan Willard's ecology service, where RE kids ran around the meeting hall, acting out birds searching for food, warding off predators, and feeding their young. He didn't include that we were sitting on those eggs. Pat Cotley's service on the occasion of the assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. Pat opened with a few words and then became so choked up with emotion that she could hardly continue. Ruth Caldron's remarkable service on the Shaker movement, which included the Shaker dance choreographed by Barbara Carson.
Well, one Prairie service was followed by a very big surprise. Barbara Park wrote about the startling event that happened in May 1993.
Well, it happened this way. Everyone came to Sunday program as usual on that May morning in 1993. The program proceeded as expected until the end, when there was time for joys and sorrows, as they were known then. Warren Hagstrom stood up when the presider called on him and said, "I have both a joy and a sorrow. The sorrow is that I'm having surgery next week. The joy is that Dolita and I are getting married." Some folks responded, "Oh, wonderful, when?" Came the answer, "Now." And they stood up and went to the front of the room.
And only 4 of us were warned in advance.
Yeah. Including Shirley Grinrod, who made a cake.
Well, Prairie gives a lot of energy to his children and their mentors. One of those mentors for 6.5 years was our director of religious education, Ann Pryor, within Green. And we've asked her to read from her memories about becoming Prairie DRE. DRE is Director of Religious Education.
And that was one of my biggest challenges, learning the acronyms. A few of the most interesting jobs I have ever had started with a Madison newspaper help wanted ad. Once it was for a part-time folklorist in residence job. I wasn't exactly sure what that was, but it sounded interesting and I figured I could do it. It turned into a great 25 plus year career at the Wisconsin Arts Board. A few years before that, in the late 1980s, the ad that caught my eye was for a director of religious education at a place called Prairie. Again, not exactly sure what that would entail, I applied and was hired for what became a 6-year job from 1988 to 1995, and a much longer church home for me and my family. When I first started as DRE, one of the most confusing parts of the job was understanding and negotiating the strong anti-religion sentiment that floated below the surface at what I thought was a church. I did not understand that in Prairie's membership was a wide continuum of beliefs: atheists, humanists, Buddhists, Jews, former Christians, active Christians, agnostics, and a few birth Unitarians or Universalists. I came to understand that Prairie was indeed a fellowship or a society and not a church. Only gradually was Prairie's fierce iconoclasm revealed and helped to explain its proud stance as, quote, "the oldest and largest lay-led society in the UUA." Prairie was a wonderful place to work as DRE. It welcomed creativity and innovation. It treasured tradition, valued its children, taught critical thinking, exhibited enduring volunteerism to support the program, and provided strong support to me as DRE. The society continues to exhibit these values today, which is one reason why I came back to Prairie as a member and have found a happy home here.
And we're glad she's here.
Thank you.
But the longest chapter in both of the volumes is chapter 10, which is who were or are And when I conceived this idea, the idea of the Prairie History Book, I wanted to celebrate the fact that it's the people who make up the church and carry out its mission. The late Reverend Max Gabler of First Unitarian Society had his inimitable way of putting it when he spoke at the dedication of this very building here in May 1980. This is what he said, and I will read it.
In a unique and special sense, a church is, or should be, a community of memory and of hope, a community that recognizes not only those individuals who happen to comprise its membership at any given moment, but that count as well to the progression of remembered faces of those who have for many years, or for a few, been part of its company. And that is always sensitive as well to those who in time have come to inherit the concern and the devotion and the substance that we in our time pass on.
That's one sentence. Well, the aim of chapter 10 is to introduce you to some of the procession of remembered faces. That's a quote from Gabler, as well as those who currently make up the body of the church. And we hope it will mean something, quote, to those in time will inherit the concern and devotion and the substance that we in time pass on. So chapter 10 begins with a chart of our ministers. Now, a typical church in its 50-year history would have had either a raft of ministers or several ministers with lengthy terms of service. Our list shows a much different picture. For 33 consecutive years of our history, Prairie was a totally lay-led congregation. And this doesn't include the first 1.5 years at the beginning and a year between our last two ministers. So here's in a nutshell Prairie's ministers, past to present. Lanier Clance, who you've heard about, the guy in the bathrobe, minister on loan for 6 weeks in 1969, then Dave Meyer, who's here, half-time minister for 2 years, 1970 to 72, then that long 33-year period of no ministers. Then Jody Weldon, quarter-time minister for a year, 2005 to 2006. Then Ralph Tiksinski, who's here, back there in the back. quarter-time, then half-time minister for 3.5 years, 2006 to 2010. Then Jane Espenson for a really short time, half-time for 7.5 months, 2010 to 2011. She got married to a Swedish man and lives in Sweden now. That's why she quit us. And then Sandra Ingham, half-time minister for 6.5 years from 2012 till this March. Now all the rest of our procession of remembered faces are lay people. We've chosen two members who have passed on and two current members who wrote about how they came to Prairie. Actually, there are about 70 other people in this portion of the book, and then pictures of the 50 new people in the last few years, including kids, that are pictured at the end of the chapter. So anyway, two of our most indefatigable past members were Pat Cotley, a charter member of Prairie in 1967, and Fran Romica, who joined in 1969. Rosemarie Lester, right there, wrote about this tribute to Pat Cotley after Pat's death in 2007. Pat's 93 at the time. And she called her tribute, "My Sister, Pat Cotley." It's just a short excerpt from a much longer part that's in your book. Rosemary's gonna read it.
Pat Cotley and I had met in 1969 when I came to UW and joined Prairie UU Society. We didn't become friends right away, but I remember being a little awed from the start by this soft-spoken, fragile-looking woman who seemed so well-informed about the political complexities of the time and who often urged responsible political action in her gentle, so precise way of speaking. Now, Pat was not one of the Prairie huggers. She was a very private person who totally respected the privacy of others. And that caring respect was strikingly demonstrated early on in what I call the case of the burnt frying pan. At a time when I was going through some hellish personal changes that even involved alcohol, I had left her shining new copper bottom pan on the fire with the expected results. The thing was nearly destroyed in a vile smelling cloud of smoke. Apologizing, I broke down in tears and blurted out all my troubles to her. And that's when she truly became my big sister. With tremendous warmth, compassion, and understanding, she really helped me to get through this awful time.
Well, another person that I remember was Fran Micah, who was truly a remarkable woman as well. I think she's really my favorite person of all those who are no longer with us. As a young woman, I learned that she rode a Harley motorcycle when women just didn't do that. Later, she helped test discrimination against African Americans in renting, and she had a strong role in the passage of Madison's open housing ordinance. And she often also rescued things from dumpsters, which I do also. And she loved every living thing from ants to mice to chickens and more. And Ruth called, you want to read the whole section there?
Okay. The Prairie Fire newsletter records other interesting information about Fran. The 9/23/1971 newsletter notes that she's the person who found the Portal Foster location on West Lawn when Prairie had to leave the YWCA. Fran was a licensed real estate broker, and her best news was that the place was cheaper to rent than the YWCA. And the same newsletter goes on to show how she lived her UU values. This is not the first exciting real estate deal Fran has conducted. Right after World War II, a young black couple asked Fran to sell them rooming houses on Mills Street. After careful negotiations, Fran closed the deal. And the agency she worked for was suspended for 3 months and fined $485. At the time, the National Professional Organization of Real Estate Brokers had a clause that no member should sell to a member of a race or character or occupation which would materially depreciate the neighborhood. We didn't pay the fine, we just did without them. Later, of course, they declared that clause unconstitutional, but I'm probably Madison's first and only woman fined and censored for selling a house to a black.
So we're getting to the end of our program now. We have two current members of the Procession of Remembered Faces, Mary Anderson and Joanna Hatch, who will read their stories of Prairie, coming to Prairie. And I know you'll find these fascinating. Peter's is called Serendipity.
Thank you, Mary. It's really well, the old riff that if you want to find the meaning of life, you don't go looking for it. It comes upon you if you're ready. Serendipity, of course, you remember, comes from Horace Walpole in 1754 with the Persian's tale of Serendip, which he made and coined the word serendipity. I'm so hammered. I can't remember for the life of me when I did this.
Yeah, you did it at the retreat.
At the retreat, okay. Okay, serendipity. I've long believed life in the fullest often arises from purely serendipitous connections that pop out of nowhere. I remember maybe it was 30 years ago reading the Smithsonian magazine, which had a feature about explorers. But what caught my eye was a handwritten letter in that article that Admiral Perry's then 7-year-old daughter had sent to him when he was in the South Pole, in which she brazenly said to her illustrious father, "I'm sick and tired of people looking at me like I'm an orphan." A decade later, I was giving a speech in Pittsburgh, and at a party that evening, for reasons I can no longer remember, I recounted that story, to which someone at the party across the room, who must have been eavesdropping, interposed, "She is now an old lady, lives here in Pittsburgh, and she still has that staid, very distinctive personality. At about that same general time when I was an environmental activist, spending much of my time opposing evil nuclear power plants, I became fascinated to learn that in its beginnings, nuclear power was advanced by the very liberal Robert Oppenheimer and his fellow radical scientists who developed the bomb at Los Alamos. And after they learned about the devastation at Hiroshima and had become consumed with guilt of what they had done, as a way out of their guilt, they saw the peaceful atom, in quotes, as a way to redeem their souls. Shortly after just that, I was invited to speak, this is where I first met Prairie, at Prairie's retreat when it was being held at Upham Woods. Around the campfire by the river, I recounted life's ironies through that Oppenheimer story, when Rose Smith spoke up and said that after the war, she babysat for Oppenheimer's little toddler, Peter. She recalled that playing in the bathtub, little Peter, no relation, would bang his hands in the water to create a big splash and say, boom, just like Daddy. Something that must have gotten to Oppenheimer in his gut. Life resonates deepest in the serendipitous connections that bring us a special joy.
And finally, we'll hear from Johanna Hatch. She wrote about coming to Prairie in what we call family church. Well, what her son called family church. She'll hear about it.
So when we first moved to Verona, I was a seminary dropout and a self-described progressive Catholic. I had been raised in the Catholic Church and was married to an adult convert, but we had no interest in what the Diocese of Madison had to offer us. We were very lucky to find Holy Wisdom Monastery, which felt similar to what we were used to, but without the exclusion and discrimination. When our son Liam was born, we decided to have him baptized into this community. As the months went on, a subtle shift took place, and I found myself attending church alone. My husband was quietly becoming an atheist, and my baby was becoming less interested in being still and quiet. I didn't want to go to church alone. For me, the act of sharing it with my family was what was most important. So one Sunday morning, I said to Evan, hey, you want to go to a UU church? They're okay with atheists. They won't try to get you to say you believe anything. I was tired of going alone, and I wanted a community for my family. Evan agreed, and we Googled our way to Prairie. We visited for a few Sundays, but the decision to join was one of the easiest we ever made. Astute little Liam, on one of those first Sundays, asked us, are we going to family church today? He had already picked up that there are many churches, the one Mommy went to, the one he visited with friends for playgroup, the one Grammy went to. But Prairie was the one where his whole family went together. And we went together because there was room for all of us and our questions, beliefs, or disbeliefs. It provided a safe place where I knew no matter who my children would grow up to be, their church would remain a welcoming home. And to me, it was a religious community where I could be fully authentic and not have to sacrifice my values to be welcomed. Family church was what I wanted, and that is what Prairie means to me. That was when we knew we would join. And as an addendum, our daughter was born in July of 2014 and dedicated by this community in November of that year, so it has really become our family church home.
Well, thank you all readers, and thank you all for listening and laughing now and then. And this concludes our introduction to the Prairie history books, and we hope you enjoyed learning a little bit about the church. And we'll go on to enjoy the book if you have them. So now it's time to talk among yourselves, eat, drink, get autographs if you want, and join us left with your refreshments. And as I say, carry on. Thanks so much for coming. Stay as long as you want. Thank you so much.